You called the fact that Bakhmut would become basically a meat grinder. You know, I know you probably don't take comfort in being right about things like that, especially with human casualty, and the Ukrainian people have fought so hard, and so has the Wagner group. But do you think it's now time for them to concede the area, fall back, regroup, build up ammunition and artillery for a few days, and then try and dig in and hold the line again? Or is it just at this point, they're just going to continue to throw bodies at the meat grinder?
Well, Bakhmut will go down in history as having been the graveyard of the Ukrainian military. That's how terrible it's been. The losses are frightening. The Ukrainians will insist, well, we've killed some Russians. Yes, that's when the exchange rate changed from 1 to 8 or 9 down to 1 to 5. So the Russians have taken some losses, but you're now comparing 30,000 dead Russians and perhaps 60, 70,000 wounded Russians with potentially up to 250,000 dead Ukrainians, plus another 300,000 or 400,000 wounded. And most of those wounded will never return to active duty. They were so severely wounded that they can't fight again. Now, this is not unprecedented. We've seen these kinds of things during World War I in 110 days of fighting, because that's all that we did in World War I in 1918. We fought for 110 days. And in that time frame, we lost 318,000 men, casualties, of which 110,000 were killed. That means that in roughly every battle, we lost 1,000 dead. That's the kind of thing that's been going on in Ukraine. So it's not unprecedented, but you can't keep that up. We came into World War I at the end of the war. The French, the British, the Russians had lost millions of people. And Germany was ultimately overwhelmed simply by numbers and materiel, and thanks to the Royal Navy, starvation. This is a different situation right now. Ukraine has never had those numbers at all, and they are now really on their last legs. There's no question about it. We keep pushing them to stay in the fight. Now, we have advised them on occasion to pull back, regroup, a new defensive line, build up your reserves. Zelensky, I think, has chosen to ignore that advice in favor of continuing to attack on the assumption that if he can gain any ground, if he can prove that the Ukrainians have any fight left in them, and the Ukrainian soldiers are excellent, that's not the question, but no human being can put up with this the way they have in Bakhmut, that somehow or another we will all rush and support them. And then I think there's the other aspect of this. I think he has hoped against hope that he could drag us in. And I think we've actually conveyed the impression to him that that might happen. That's a terrible thing to say. It's a lie. We were never going to involve ourselves directly in a confrontation with Russia. Now, there were times when we flirted with it. This coalition of the willing. But my understanding is that's largely gone away now. And there's been a much more sober-minded assessment. We realize we can't go into this. You know, our war stocks are exhausted. We've emptied them. The Europeans never had large ones to begin with, because they've been essentially vassal states of the greater American empire now for decades, and they assumed that we would come in and fight for them. So there's not much left. Russia is just at the peak of its power right now. It's mobilized. It's got unending quantities of ammunition and equipment. It's ready to fight. So the notion that we're going to motor into Western Ukraine and challenge them is a lot of nonsense. I think that's finally sunk in. That's why I think there's a movement now to try and figure out how do we disengage without looking ridiculous. That's going to be pretty tough, because we lied to the Ukrainians. We've lied to our own population. We've lied to the Europeans, conveyed the impression that we could do something we can't. The Russians have not said a great deal, but they've done a lot. And a lot of us thought that they would attack in January. But the problem was they never got the ground freeze that they needed to support their maneuver. And again, people have to understand, in that part of eastern Ukraine, the black earth, which is some of the most fertile ground in the world. In fact, during World War II, the Germans loaded rail cars with black earth from Ukraine and shipped it back to Germany to improve their agricultural output. People don't know that. But this earth is about 10 to 15 deep in most cases, 10 to 15 feet deep in most cases. And unless you get a freeze in the winter, you just sink into the mud. Now we're into the muddy season, and the muddy season lasts potentially until May, sometimes even longer, which is why most of the major offensive operations that the Soviets launched came in the summer, because by then everything was dry and you had a chance to maneuver. For that matter, the same thing was true for the Germans. So the bottom line is this thing is over, except for the announcement of reality that this cannot go on. The humane thing to do right now, which is not what we have done, is to intervene and say, that's it. We've got to stop this and start talking to the Russians, not demanding of the Russians what we want, but saying, look, tell us what your conditions are, tell us what you want, and we will move to the best of our ability to meet those needs. And really, this, we're back to the old story. Make Ukraine neutral. It could have been neutral from day one. We could have avoided all of this. It doesn't have to be a member of NATO. And then secondly, treat the Russians that live within Ukraine's borders as equal citizens. Stop oppressing them. Stop brutalizing them. Stop treating them as third-class citizens. Equality before the law for everybody in Ukraine. The Ukrainians wanted to, quote-unquote, forcibly Ukrainianize Russians. Give up your language, your culture, your identity, or get out. I mean, this was unacceptable, and the Russians are sitting there watching this. So I don't know what happens now, but you're going to get a different territorial outcome. These borders will be adjusted, and there's not much that the Ukrainians could do. And we are not prepared to march east into eastern Ukraine with hundreds of thousands of European allies to fight this war. In the meantime, you have this economic catastrophe developing in the United States and Europe. It's not just the banking system. It's larger than that. The underlying fundamentals are terrible. I was shocked the other day when I discovered that a firm in Germany, in Saxony, which is the area that we used to call East Germany, which is really middle Germany historically, there's a firm there that's involved with metals, forming metals, shaping metals, developing alloys. The firm's been in business since 1380. It just went under.
Why?
In Germany, this is incomprehensible. Thousands of people are losing their jobs because there's no cheap energy. Cheap energy fuels everything. What do you think happened in the United States with Standard Oil and J.D. Rockefeller? That was cheap energy. That's why between the Civil War and World War I, we became an economic, scientific, industrial juggernaut. You can't sustain yourself in that category. You can't maintain your standards of living and prosperity without affordable energy. Germany's in a lot of trouble, and I don't think the Germans are very happy about it. It's going to get worse before it gets better, because you just don't turn on energy and restore your prosperity. It takes time to build back. So the old build back better regime in Washington has done just about everything it can to destroy us and our European allies.
Yeah, it feels like Build Back Broker, to be honest. You know, and that's what I cover on my daily show. Okay, sticking with the energy topic and the financial situation, do you think, I don't think the United States and the media is going to hold President Biden accountable for blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They're doing everything they can to cover for the sitting president. But I don't know that Europe cares. And they're protesting, they want answers, and they want that cheap energy, even if it's from somebody like Putin. Do you think that President Biden could be in trouble throughout the rest of this year when it comes to the financial situation and the Nord Stream 2 attack on Germany, who now, you know, is in desperate need of affordable energy?
I think things are going to get much worse here in the United States over the next 60 days. Now, I am not a financial analyst, nor do I claim to be an economist. Of course, John Kenneth Galbraith once said that economists exist to make astrologers look professional. So I don't feel too badly about making some statements, but I think as these interest rates hike, and that's what they're going to do, they're going to hike interest rates again in June, it makes it that much more difficult in the banking system, where there's almost no credit at this point anyway. you cannot have price and interest rate stability simultaneously under the current circumstances. The more you hike the interest rates, the worse the situation becomes. There's something else too. Americans don't understand very well. Washington doesn't understand at all. We are not the nation of 1991. Now, we began shipping out, when I say we, I'm talking about your ruling class of corporate bigwigs and politicians. We began shipping out our industrial base to China and elsewhere back under Ronald Reagan. Nobody ever points that out, but this process of sort of shipping it out for cheap labor costs started in the 80s. Today, we simply don't have the scientific industrial base that we did 30 years ago. So that if you restart the economy, if you will, there are not hundreds of thousands of jobs out there for people that are going to do them. When Franklin Roosevelt dragged us into World War II, we had vast numbers of factories. Our whole industrial base was sitting idle. But when we started the war, suddenly millions of people showed up and we went back to work because we had an industrial base. We don't have one now. That's a huge problem. This is what Donald Trump was talking about. He was trying to repatriate industries. He was trying to restart industry by focusing on what I would call high-end manufacturing. In other words, not low-end stuff, high-end stuff. He was trying to reinvigorate agriculture, reinvigorate the energy production systems. That's what he was trying to do. That was stopped dead in its tracks. It's going to take us a decade or more to restart all of those things in the right direction. That's the problem. You have a similar problem now in a place like Germany, because Germany is really the industrial engine of Europe. There's nobody else in Europe compared with Germany in terms of its productivity and its scientific industrial capacity. These things are going to take time. I think Biden is going to end up being the scapegoat for the left. I mean, I call him the cardboard cutout president, because I don't think he's really there. I don't think he's really in charge. I think he reads and says whatever you put in front of him. And then he saunters off, you know, to the door and walks out of the room. Others are in charge who were not elected. These are people that were either appointed or there as assistants or advisors or something. I don't even know who they are, but I'm sure if you go down the list of the employees in the White House and some of the people that are listed as advisors, you'll find out. But those are the people running our country, not Joseph Biden. And then you have irresponsible people like Lindsey Graham and Chuck Schumer and others. They're just along for the ride. They haven't paid attention to anything. How many times have we hiked the debt ceiling? How long has this been going on? Well, it's a party. You know, why stop now? Open up another case of champagne. That's what's been going on for decades. It's all about to stop. So if you're on the left and you look at this catastrophe approaching, Russia wins in Ukraine unambiguously. The whole thing is a catastrophe. The Ukrainian nation is killed, literally destroyed. Millions have left the country. They're never going back. It's awful. I don't even want to begin to talk about the terrible ramifications for Ukrainians, because people mistake something. They say, well, you're a Putin agent because, well, no, I'm not a Putin agent. I'm not necessarily pro-Russian. I'm not necessarily pro-Ukrainian. In fact, I like them both from personal experience growing up, especially with Ukrainians. Has nothing to do with it. This war should not have happened. We could have stopped it in its tracks in the first week. We could have prevented it from ever happening if we had simply listened to Moscow and what they wanted, which was no NATO nation on their borders. Specifically, they didn't want a NATO army and they didn't want U.S. missiles sitting in eastern Ukraine aimed at their cities and their nuclear deterrent. All of this was avoidable. So we brought all of this on. We forced this to happen. So what do? You look at Biden, you say, well, it's his fault. He becomes the scapegoat for everything. And he's resigning. And we have a wonderful opportunity. We'll have the first non-white woman as president of the United States. Isn't that wonderful? Really? Well, we'll see what happens with that. I mean, we're in new territory now. This is, Steve, this is a world we've never seen before. We're watching this entire structure of power that has been built up over decades fall apart. We could have managed all of this differently. We put everything at risk. We're going to watch NATO sort of gradually die alone in the corner. You know, Henry James said, sacred cows are never slain. They simply vanish. Our sacred cows are going to vanish. No one's going to stand up and say, oh, well, today we bury NATO. Today we bury this or that or the next thing. No, it'll just drift away. And we're going to drift away out of Europe, out of Ukraine. We're going to drift away from lots of places because we're bankrupt. That's the sad truth. And no one should be surprised. And I think when the Americans wake up some morning over the next 90 days, they're going to be furious. And I think the first step will be, well, we'll blame it on Joe Biden. He's the scapegoat. Then it's the Wild West.
Wow, thank you. This has been very, very insightful. And I believe the viewers will really enjoy this. One last question, then I'll let you go. I appreciate your time. You mentioned that the humane thing would be for the United States to step in and say, this war is over, let's be done. Don't you feel like China is trying to fill that vacuum where they're now saying, oh, Saudi Arabia and Iran, there's a lot of money to be made. Let's broker peace. Russia, Ukraine, hey, the United States is not going to step in. We are going to step in and broker peace. Is this one more way for China to try to eclipse the United States on the world stage?
Well, first of all, I do not subscribe to the view that China wants to eclipse us. They know they can't. They have serious problems internally as well. The biggest problem China has always faced throughout most of its history is it's too big to do much more than it's already done. They have 1.4 billion people. Every day Xi wakes up and is trying to figure out, how do I hold this place together? How do I stop it from falling apart? I'm serious. China is not some sort of martial state that wants desperately to go to war anywhere. On the contrary, they fear it. They don't want it. Now, when you look at Ukraine, Ukraine sits astride all of the routes, all of the railroads, and everything that comes out of Central Asia and China into Europe. China has been trying to build this thing they call One Belt, One Road. Essentially, they want to restore the commerce lines that existed under the Mongols after the Mongols conquered China, between China, Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asia and Europe. You go right across the center of Central Asia with your rail lines. This war has to stop if that's going to happen. The Chinese desperately want this war over because they want to build those lines. We want to stop that commerce. Well, that's right up there in the category of let's stop Niagara Falls. How do you stop Europe and Northeast Asia from trading with each other? If you look at Europe, Russia and Europe on one side, on the Western side, and you can add North America with this, and then on the other side, Northeast Asia. Those are the two poles of scientific industrial power and production on the planet. If those two poles go to war, the world is lost. The rest of the world desperately needs both of us. So no, the Chinese are not looking for war, and they're not necessarily interested in displacing us. They're trying to build their commercial economic empire, if you will. And the Russians have a critical role in all of this because the Russians are the muscle in Central Asia. They provide security for those lines of communication, for the rail lines. No one in Central Asia trusts the Chinese. No one in Asia beyond China's borders trusts the Chinese. People are not stupid, but they're not afraid of an invasion, not a military invasion, but they're all very, very concerned about the Chinese. You know, whenever I've gone over on business in Northeast Asia, where I talk to my friends that are in Korea or Japan, they always laugh and say the same thing. You Americans are stupid. Do you see any Chinese in our laboratories, in our universities? Of course not. The Chinese do what they've always done. If you leave it on the table, they'll steal it. That's what they do. They've been doing it for thousands of years. Everyone in Asia knows everyone else. We're the ones that don't know anything because we sit back from the rest of the world convinced that we have all the answers. We're the shining city on the hill. Everybody needs to emulate us. And by the way, if you don't, We club you over the head either with our control of the financial system and the dollar or our military establishment. Well, the world is saying, no thanks. We've had enough of this. We need to be part of the world, but we don't have to bully it. And that's what we've got to come to terms with. So people like Lindsey Graham and Schumer and the rest of these people need to shut up. We don't need to bully anybody. When you bully the rest of the world, you end up in a position we're in now. We're being increasingly isolated by our own stupidity. All we need to do is stop it. We need to be prepared to do business with everybody and stop dictating to everyone everywhere how they will govern themselves. And if we have a dispute of some kind with what someone else somewhere wants to do internally, we can deal with that privately. You know, we don't have to deal with it in public, and we can make our views known. And that frequently has more effect than publicly humiliating your business partner. So all this sort of arrogance and hubris needs to go away.